for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young. Coming up, day three of a political protest in Iran. We'll talk to a striking member of parliament.
And is Iran next up for neocons like Richard Perle?
We have just finished a major enterprise in Iraq. It isn't finished yet, in fact. I certainly wouldn't criticize the administration for gathering itself up before taking on the next great challenge.
Also, 40 years on from the Surgeon General's report on smoking and its health hazards, is enough being done?
The disabled discard their wheelchairs and crawl up the Supreme Court steps to draw attention to a case on the docket.
And R&B and the Holmes Brothers.
These stories and more are coming up here and now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Bush has reversed U.S. policy involving Iraqi building contracts in Canada. He announced his change at a joint photo opportunity with new Canadian Prime Minister Paul Martin.
Canada right now is eligible for subcontracting bids in the first round of construction projects. In the second round, the second tranche of bidding, Canada will be eligible to bid.
The United States has banned countries that oppose the war in Iraq from bidding on several projects in Iraq. Many allies were angered, but Canada will be able to join the second round of bidding. Former Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill denies he has taken any secret documents from the Treasury Department. Hours after O'Neill criticized President Bush's leadership on CBS's 60 Minutes program, the Treasury Department announced it was investigating how a document marked secret was shown during the program. But speaking on NBC today, O'Neill said the documents were given to him by the Treasury's chief legal officer and were not secret.
I don't honestly think there's anything that's classified in those 19,000 documents. There was a cover sheet that had classified attachments, but the attachments were not included in the file.
O'Neill says he's not surprised the Treasury is looking into how he got the documents. He says if he were secretary, he'd do the same. The Supreme Court has ruled police can stop motorists randomly to locate criminals. The ruling was 6-3. The justices said if police use the roadblocks to find information about recent crimes, privacy rights of Americans are not violated. This ruling overturns the Illinois Supreme Court. That state court had ruled against police when they'd stopped cars to pass out leaflets looking for information about a hit-and-run driver. A man who'd been stopped at the time was arrested for drunken driving. Authorities in Britain say a British family doctor blamed for the deaths of more than 200 elderly patients has killed himself in prison. A prison spokesman says Dr. Harold Shipman's body was found hanging from bedsheets in his cell this morning. The BBC's John Thorne is at the Wakefield Prison in northern England.
Harold Shipman would have been 58 tomorrow. And although he had been on suicide watch before his trial while on remand in Manchester Prison and when he was first sentenced, a prison service statement said there was absolutely nothing in his behaviour inside Wakefield Prison to indicate he was likely to attempt suicide. The statement said there'd been no intelligence about threats to Shipman. His behaviour had been consistent and gave no cause for concern.
The BBC's John Thorne reporting. Shipman was convicted of killing 15 patients. A judge later ruled Shipman killed at least 200 other people. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 112 points at 10,373. The Nasdaq is down 31 at 2,080. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, a financial team is working to save bankrupt Italian food company Parmalat. An Italian government minister says the team wants to keep the basic parts of the company under Italian control. Some of Parmalat's international subsidiaries may be sold. Parmalat plummeted into bankruptcy last month after company officials acknowledged billions of company dollars were missing. The company's founder is in jail being questioned by prosecutors. Chicago-based Abbott Labs has reached a deal to purchase a leading manufacturer of self-testing blood kits for people with diabetes. Chicago Public Radio's Tim White has more.
California-based TheraSense is the maker of Freestyle, a less painful pocket-sized monitoring system allowing diabetics to quickly test their blood sugar levels. Today, Abbott Laboratories announced it is buying TheraSense's stock for $1.2 billion. TheraSense officials believe the move will create significant advances in research and development of the technology. The World Health Organization estimates there are 185 million people with diabetes worldwide. This number is expected to grow to 500 million by 2025 due to aging populations and increasing obesity. Analysts expect blood sugar monitor sales to have reached more than $5 billion in 2003, a projection they expect to grow about 10% annually. For NPR News, I'm Tim White in Chicago.
Radio Corporation Clear Channel says it'll create several community panels to advise the company about its business. Clear Channel owns about 1,200 stations across the country. It's been criticized for limiting the scope and number of songs radio stations can play, as well as for its political actions. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
The NPR Shop features Driveway Moments, a CD compilation of public radio stories so compelling they won't let you go, at npr.org.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The standoff in Iran between the hardline conservative Guardian Council and reformist politicians was ratcheted up a notch today when 12 top government officials threw their weight behind the reformers, reportedly threatening to quit. For a third day running, dozens of current members of parliament are holding a strike at the parliament building, protesting the Guardian Council's ban on thousands of reformist candidates, including 80 current members of parliament who'd won seats in a landslide. Elahi Koulari is one of them. She is in the parliament building right now, and she joins us on her cell phone. Elahi, as well as we can hear you, tell us, the Guardian Council rules with an iron fist. You are defying their ruling, claiming it's illegal. Do you fear punishment for your protest?
There are some possibilities in this respect, but we think we are trying in the framework of rule, and we try to protect the Constitution, and we try to promote the process of reform in our country and protection the rights of all people. And we think that it is our duty. We must try to protect the civil rights of people, the rights of election, free and fair election.
Elahi, we hear reports that the people are not protesting along with you, that the students' rights organizations have not taken to the streets, and that, in fact, the public is not responding because they're disappointed in reformist politicians. They don't think there was enough reform, and so they're not supporting you.
Yes, we don't want that they go to the street, they come to the streets to protection us, because we try to move very, very smoothly and very calmly because of the situation of our country.
Elahi, how long are you prepared to strike?
Until reaching to the declared goals, to free and fair election for all the people.
Elahi Koulari, thank you so much.
Thank you, too.
Elahi Koulari, a striking parliament member, speaking to us from the parliament building in Iran. Well, we now turn to Nazila Fati. She's a reporter for the New York Times in Tehran. And Nazila, you're there. How dangerous is the situation with protesters in parliament?
Well, it wouldn't be dangerous as long as the protest stays within the parliament. There have been no signs of street protests or popular protests on the streets in support of the strikers in parliament.
And why is that?
Well, part of it is because reformers lost a lot of their support. The election is happening at a time when people are extremely disillusioned with what happened in parliament in the past 4 years. Part of it is because of the obstacles that the reformers were faced with.
What impact is this all having on sitting President Khatami, a reformist? Will he join his MPs and also step down?
that's what everybody's wondering about. He has said that he will take action, but he has never taken radical action in the past since he became president. There are doubts whether he would resign, whether he would go that far.
Why did the Guardian Council take this move, this ban, now?
Well, the Guardian Council is controlled by the hardliners, by the conservative politicians, and it seems that this time they want to do everything to make sure that they will control Parliament, even if that means stealing the election.
And is it because they know they can, as you said, because the public might be disenchanted with the reformists anyway?
With a lower turnout, they can definitely win the parliament, but they want to make sure they don't want to take any risks this time. They don't want to let leading reformists run and maybe change the mood 2 days or even a little before the election.
How much, if at all, Nazila, do you think the hardliners are influenced by the very budding democracy right on their borders in Iraq?
I am not so sure that the election has much to do with what's happening in Iraq. It's been part of the political competition since President Khatami was elected 6 years ago. And I think if conservatives control the parliament, they will put aside a lot of their ideological obstacles that they are creating for the reformers. We don't know. I'm not sure how far democracy will go forward, but it seems that they are willing to give more cultural and social freedom.
Yeah, it seems as if, and you write that, in fact, the conservatives, the hardliners, seem to have co-opted some of the reformist agenda.
They have a lot. I mean, at least in terms of foreign policy, they have made two major changes in the past few months. They were the ones who signed the additional protocol to the non-proliferation treaty, and they took a major step to improve relations with Egypt. Mm.
Do you think this is going to become a full-blown crisis or not?
We have to see what the reformers will do next. I mean, as long as they are in the parliament and they're holding sit-in, it is not such a big crisis. It all depends on how the government of President Khatami would react.
Well, we will wait with you to see. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Nazila Fatih, correspondent for The New York Times, speaking to us from Tehran, Iran.
Nazila Fatih just said she doesn't believe the crackdown in Iran has much to do with the war next door in Iraq. But others think there may be a link. Among them, some of the most prominent architects of Bush administration foreign policy, the so-called neoconservatives, like Richard Perle. As a member of the influential Defense Policy Board, Perle has argued for many years that a prime motivation for bringing down Saddam Hussein was to begin creating democracy in Iraq and so inspire reform throughout the Middle East, including in Iran. We're joined now by Richard Perle, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Mr. Perle, do you think that this seeming crackdown by the mullahs in Iran is a result of what happened in Iraq?
I think they're very worried about what happened in Iraq. Liberation is infectious, and this is a brutal dictatorship. It dominates every aspect of people's lives. It's a small number of mullahs at the top, corrupt, to be sure, and they are nervous.
But where we want to get democracy in Iran, how do you get there from 130,000 coalition troops, U.S. troops, primarily in Iraq?
By helping 25 million Iranians who want to free themselves from this regime.
And how do you do that? Militarily?
I don't believe it's necessary to do it militarily, but they need to know that the outside world is watching, and therefore the ability of the regime to use violence to crack down will be limited. They need to know the regime will be isolated, scorned, and despised. All of those things can achieve important results. We saw the democratization of Spain and Portugal years ago by similar political means.
We tried all sorts of ways to isolate the regime in Iraq. At the end of the day, it took a war to bring it down.
Well, I think they were different situations. There have been massive indications of opposition to the regime of the mullahs in Iran, demonstrations in the streets in favor of change, and the United States, by the way. You never saw that in Iraq, because Saddam's brutality was at such an extreme that it was a death sentence to stick your head above the parapet, so nobody did. Iran is different. There was a candlelight vigil marking our losses on September 11, in which 30,000 Iranians participated.
Above all, you write in your new book, Iran's dissidents need the consistent and vocal support of the United States. They need us to make clear that we regard Iran's current government as illegitimate and intolerable, and that we support the brave souls who are struggling to topple it. The United States, you write, has done almost none of those things. Why do we hesitate? Why does the Bush administration hesitate, in your opinion?
Well, I think all American administrations have hesitated. There's a sense that every time we get involved with Iran, things go terribly wrong. I think it's a failure of nerve. There's a question of timing, too. We have just finished a major enterprise in Iraq. It isn't finished yet, in fact. And there's time. I certainly wouldn't criticize the administration for gathering itself up before taking on the next great challenge.
The next great challenge, is it more than rhetoric?
I think it must be more than rhetoric.
Meaning?
Meaning that if the president is going to continue, as he has done, to express his sympathy for the people of Iran, then we need a vigorous diplomatic effort in support of that.
Hmm. But a prime motivation, at least in the intellectual architecture that led up to the war, was that the possibility of democracy in Iraq would create brush fires of democracy throughout the region. Do you see that happening?
I believe that we will see emerging from this an Iraq that is moving in a seriously moving in a democratic direction, representative government with a level of contentment and satisfaction among the population broadly that is associated with societies in which people have a say in their own lives. And I think that will have its influence on the region. It isn't a case of dominoes, as it's sometimes described, or brush fires, for that matter. But the example will be there. If people have a decent life in Iraq a year from now, Iranians and Syrians and Saudis are going to look at that and say, why can't we have something like that?
But isn't the crackdown in Iran an indicator of just the opposite, that regimes in the Middle East nervous about maintaining their authority will only tighten up to avoid the kind of openness that we all dream about in Iraq?
Well, they will try, of course. That's what dictators always do. The question is, for how long can they sustain those policies, and how much opposition will they elicit in the course of trying to do so? It isn't easy to change dictatorial regimes, especially those that have been entrenched for so long, but it's fundamentally in the interest of the United States.
Richard Pearl, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And as always, we welcome your thoughts on anything on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or anything you think should be on the program. You can call our listener line, too, and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397.
And you can mail your letters to Here and Now, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215.
Just ahead, a new study suggests a certain vitamin supplement may cut the risk of multiple sclerosis in women by almost 50%.
And later, the federal government will soon launch two new programs for air travelers, including background checks, ID cards, and a color code.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
New research suggests that a woman's chance of developing multiple sclerosis may be reduced by as much as 40% just by taking a daily dose of vitamin D. Published today in the journal Neurology, the new study is an analysis of health information from more than 180,000 women. Cassandra Munger from the Harvard School of Public Health in Boston is the lead author. Cassandra, were you surprised by this result?
No, Robin, we were not surprised by these results. Previous studies have found that vitamin D may be protective against multiple sclerosis. Specifically, studies have found that people with high exposure to the sun, which is a primary source for vitamin D for the majority of people, may have a protective effect against MS. Mm. Additionally, studies in animals with an animal model of MS have found that vitamin D supplementation can prevent the development of that disease as well as slow or stop its progression in animals with the disease.
Well, lowering the risk, though, by 40%, that seems huge. Is that specifically from taking a supplement, or can it be diet or exposure to sunlight?
Well, in our study, the 40% reduction came from a high intake of vitamin D, specifically from the multivitamins.
And how much is the recommended doses in a multi, and can you take a separate supplement?
Typical multivitamin preparations contain 400 international units of vitamin D. And yes, there are supplements, vitamin D-specific supplements available that can have any amount greater than 400 international units.
Hmm. And is it just women, not men?
Well, our study was only in women. Though it's biologically plausible that the same effect would hold in men, we didn't study that here.
Mm. And is this the final word on this? Should people rush out and take vitamin D to prevent multiple sclerosis?
This is absolutely not the final word. Our study provides further support that vitamin D may protect against MS, but the evidence is not yet conclusive.
Yeah.
Our study needs to be confirmed with other investigations, but if it turns out that 400 international units per day of vitamin D can prevent about 40% of the cases of MS, the public health implications would be quite large. Yeah. Thousands of cases of MS could potentially be prevented by taking a multivitamin.
Well, Cassandra, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Cassandra Munger from the Harvard School of Public Health in Boston.
40 years ago this week, the Surgeon General of the United States issued the first report on smoking and health. Smoking, he said, is a health hazard. Remedial action is warranted. And so we've had four decades of health warnings, taxes, smoking bans, and multimillion-dollar lawsuits. So what worked and what didn't? And what's next? Stephen Schroeder is professor of health and health policy at the director of a Stop Smoking Center at the University of California. Dr. Schroeder, welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
Doctor, about a quarter of American men still smoke, about a fifth of women. Now, that's down a lot from peak rates in the 50s and 60s, but how well are we doing?
Well, we're doing much better than we used to, but there's a long way that we can go. It's true that we've cut our cigarette smoking rates about in half over the past 30 or 40 years, but we're still losing 430,000 people every year who die from smoking. And what's interesting is that 50,000 of those are non-smokers, who are dying of heart disease and other illnesses because they've inhaled someone else's smoke.
Wow. Now, I read that 70% of the 46 million smokers in the United States say they want to quit, 70%.
That's correct.
Only 5% will manage to pull it off without assistance.
Even maybe less than that. It's a very addictive habit. Nicotine is as addictive as morphine or cocaine or heroin. I mean, it's really tough once you're hooked.
47% of men worldwide smoke. Only 12% of women worldwide smoke. So are we doing better than some places anyway?
Well, one of the reasons the United States levels have come down so much is because we have a whole lot of citizens' movements. And they're the ones who've really been responsible for smoke-free bars and restaurants and workplaces. And often the politicians have had to kind of follow. And our government doesn't do as well as some of the other governments, like the English or the Canadians or the Australians.
Doctor, the evidence has been in for some time, 40 years and more, that smoking can kill you. Why is it still legal?
That's a wonderful question. If tobacco were to come on the market now, there's no way that it would get an approval to be marketed. I mean, we worry about mad cow disease from beef. There's not a single person in the United States who's had that. And yet we've got 430,000 deaths from smoking.
Wow.
But it's been with us since the 1600s. It's a powerful industry that influences the politicians. And so it's going to be with us for quite some time.
I smoked, I will confess, in, you know, a pretty long time ago now. Cigarettes were so much cheaper then than they are now. Does taxing cigarettes, making them very expensive, work?
What works to get people not to smoke or to quit? One of them is to make it cost more. And so taxing is certainly the best way of doing that. A second way is to counter-market, to sort of combat the $11.2 billion that the tobacco industry spends on trying to promote its products. Third way is to make it harder to do it socially, to not be able to smoke in airplanes and in bars and in restaurants and in stores.
What doesn't work to get people to quit smoking?
We're not sure that focusing on keeping kids from buying underage works. We're not sure that putting warning labels on cigarettes work. We're not sure that educating in the public schools works.
Doctor, a final question then. If somebody put $1 million in your lap, what would you spend the money on?
I would try to let every smoker know that there's an easy way they could quit by either working with their doctor or these 1-800 toll-free quit lines.
Easy way to quit?
Easy way to quit.
Easy.
Easy way to quit.
It can be done. Okay.
It can be done. Rates of up to 25%. And if you don't make it the first time, try a second, try a third, try a fourth. There are now more former smokers in the United States than current smokers.
Dr. Stephen Schroeder, professor of health and health policy at the University of California in San Francisco. Dr. Schroeder, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, President Bush says we can afford to send an American astronaut to Mars. Well, we'll talk to journalist Greg Easterbrook, who does the math and says the numbers don't even come close.
That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, a Tennessee court asked a disabled man to crawl or be carried up the steps to his court hearing. It may have been unseemly, but was it unconstitutional? Today, the U.S. Supreme Court hears arguments.
And rhythm and blues, according to the Holmes brothers. How'd their sound get so eclectic?
Many of the black stations, the wattage was not so much. We'd be listening to that Jimmy Reed, and all of a sudden, bam, here's Hank Williams. So we got exposed to all different kinds.
These stories, coming up here and now.
I'm Steve Brown. At the summit of the Americas today in Monterrey, Mexico, the president met with Paul Martin, the new prime minister of Canada, in an effort to mend relations with that country. President Bush says America's northern neighbor will be eligible for a second round of U.S. construction contracts in Iraq.
Canada right now is eligible for subcontracting bids in the first round construction projects. In the second round, the second tranche of bidding, Canada will be eligible to bid.
The U.S. had angered many allies last month by banning firms in countries that had opposed the war in Iraq from bidding on reconstruction projects in the war-torn country. The Associated Press reports that the U.N. plans to send a small team to Baghdad within 2 weeks to assess security. The move comes 2 months after all U.N. staff was ordered out of Iraq following attacks on the U.N. headquarters in the Iraqi capital. The first attack killed 22 people, including top envoy Sergio Vieira de Mello. Meanwhile, another U.S. helicopter has been shot down in Iraq, but the two-man crew escaped unharmed. Voters in the nation's capital are going to the polls today in a presidential primary, but it really doesn't count. Only a handful of the 9 Democratic contenders are on the ballot, and no delegates to the convention will be chosen as a result of today's vote. Meanwhile, in Iowa, the votes will count when tallying takes place at that state's caucuses next Monday. Only John Kerry and John Edwards are campaigning there today, although the rest of the pack are expected in the Hawkeye State later in the week. Connecticut Governor John Rawlins says he is not going to quit. The embattled Republican is rejecting calls from within his own party and elsewhere to resign. Rowland admitted accepting gifts from state employees and a state contractor. He says he's made mistakes, apologized, and has taken responsibility. Now he just wants to get back to work. A moderate earthquake shook eastern Taiwan today, but no damage or injuries are reported. The magnitude 5 earthquake was centered about 90 miles southeast of the capital, Taipei. A magnitude 5 quake can cause considerable damage. Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan says creeping protectionism could hurt the flexibility of the global economy. In a speech in Berlin, Germany, Greenspan said the costs of any new protectionist moves by the U.S. could significantly erode the flexibility of the global economy. On Wall Street today, stocks are down. The Dow is down 79 points at 10,406. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Disabilities rights advocates chanting "Justice for All, We Won't Crawl" put aside their wheelchairs and crawled up the steps of the U.S. Supreme Court today to make a point about an important disabilities rights case being heard by the High Court. It's the case of George Lane, who himself had to crawl up 2 flights of stairs in a Tennessee courthouse, which didn't have an elevator. Lane was arrested for noncompliance when he refused to crawl up the stairs a second time or be carried. Today's protest adds to what's already been a busy week for the Supreme Court. Jonathan Turley teaches at George Washington University Law School. And Jonathan, what is at stake in this case, Tennessee versus Lane?
Well, the Lane case has a couple of issues that are very important. One, which is the most obvious, is the access of disabled individuals to courthouses and other important public buildings. But underlying this case is something even more fundamental. The Supreme Court has for years conducted what has been called the Federalism Revolution under Chief Justice Rehnquist. That is, about a decade ago, they began to reassert the immunity of states under the 11th Amendment so that the Congress cannot require monetary damages to be imposed against the states, which is in line with the original views of the framers.
States' rights. Well, George Lane is saying that he was humiliated, forced to crawl up these steps in order to make a hearing for a driving charge. He is suing. What is the state of Tennessee arguing in return?
What they are arguing, quite simply, is that this comes very close to a 2001 ruling called the Board of Trustees of the University of Alabama versus Garrett. And in Garrett, the court said that Congress could not hold states accountable for damages under a different section of the ADA.
The American with Disabilities Act.
That's right. And that was based under the same 11th Amendment type of arguments. So the court will have to distinguish this case, and it's going to be difficult to distinguish.
Well, briefly, while we have you, this morning the Supreme Court also released a decision on police roadblocks, saying Chicago area police were correct to arrest a drunk driver they nabbed at an informational roadblock that was set up to collect tips about a completely different crime. Briefly, the importance of this case.
Well, it's important because the Supreme Court has been all over the field when it comes to roadblocks. And quite frankly, as someone who teaches in this area, it's irritating because on one hand, they ruled previously that roadblocks could be used for sobriety checkpoints. But then they ruled later that they could not be used if you were looking for drug use as opposed to alcohol abuse. And now they've argued that you can use it if you're looking for a specific crime. It's still quite confused as an area, but what the court here is saying is that if you have a specific crime in mind and it's a brief stop, it's permissible under the U.S. Constitution.
And very briefly, before we let you go, yesterday the High Court refused to take up a terrorism-related case. That's when they refused to hear an appeal by civil liberties advocates who said the Bush administration improperly withheld the identities of hundreds of people detained after September 11th. Your views on this?
Well, people have made a big deal out of this, but remember, this is a denial of a hearing. It's not necessarily an endorsement of the lower ruling.
It's still a big win for the Bush administration.
It's a win, but the court has also accepted another detainee case involving the Guantanamo Bay, and they have also taken two enemy combatant issues. So the administration is looking at some very serious cases, and this may be a situation where the court feels that it's going to pretty much cover the field already with these other cases.
Jonathan, thank you.
Thank you.
Jonathan Turley, Professor of Public Interest Law at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. Airline travelers who agree to submit to background checks may soon carry ID cards that would allow them to avoid being routinely selected for extra security screening. The program, known as Registered Traveler, would still require passengers to go through regular security screenings, such as metal detectors and baggage scanning. Well, joining us on the line from Washington, D.C. is Sarah Gu. She covers airline security for The Washington Post. And Sarah, what's new about this program as opposed to others proposed and some implemented in the past?
Well, what this program would do is allow passengers who, most of them they imagine, would be frequent flyers to volunteer their information, such as their address, their phone number, maybe some other details, to the government in exchange for some kind of security pass that will allow them to go through screening faster.
Right. But they still would have to be screened. And I understand that there was resistance to this in the past because it was thought, well, couldn't a wealthy terrorist get involved with a frequent flyer program or a business and then get into this program and be less scrutinized?
Exactly. I mean, the administration has flip-flopped on this. That was their initial concern about starting such a program right after the September 11th attacks. But they believe that now it's safe to do so because they would provide some kind of biometric identity that will verify the identity of the passenger. And also they believe that since there will be some level of checkpoint screening for these passengers, they will at least be able to, you know, still go through the detection to see whether they're carrying weapons or other dangerous items on board.
In fact, we understand that Airline Travelers Association is actually a little disappointed. They were hoping for a little more for frequent travelers.
Yeah, I think the airlines have always been supportive of this idea. They want to remove what they call the hassle factor of security. But, of course, there has to be some compromise, and I think the government has said for this program, we might eliminate for some passengers what we call secondary screening, which is the full-blown pat-down that you see being done at airports.
Which, of course, also brings up the other concern is this sort of creates a class system of travelers, which reminds me of another move by the government. They are apparently now going to compel airlines to hand over passenger lists, and then they're going to color code passengers depending on their security risk.
Right. Air travel will be so different this year. We'll see this summer if this program gets off the ground. Every time you fly and you buy an airline ticket, the government is going to rate you. They're going to give you a numerical score and a color score, red, yellow, or green. Essentially, they're going to probe your background to see whether, you know, you might be a suspected terrorist, a wanted criminal, or somebody they just can't fully identify.
And in which case you might be subjected to more screening.
Well, here's how it's going to work. If you're green, you will go through the security checkpoint as you normally do. If you're yellow, you will get some additional screening, such as the full hand wanding and search. And if you're red, they say you're going to be met at the airport by a police officer.
But we understand, too, from reading your column, that, in fact, there already is. I had no idea that if you're targeted for additional screening, you will see an SSS or three stars on your boarding pass.
Right. Well, the color code I just described is a replacement system to the one that already exists. Right now, if you buy a ticket paying with cash or a one-way ticket, they assume that you might be a suspected terrorist, and so you're given a code on your boarding pass.
Because, of course, they did that in the past.
Exactly.
So there already is a rating system in effect in some way.
There is already, and that system, the TSA has said, is outdated, and that's why we have this new proposal about the red, yellow, and green, which has already sparked quite a bit of controversy.
Sarah, thank you.
Thank you.
Sarah Gu covers airline security for The Washington Post.
The Holmes Brothers coming up, out with a new CD.
You're listening to Here and Now. Is there anything more forlorn than a discarded, undressed Christmas tree sitting so soon after its recent glory with the trash on the sidewalk? But wait, they can still make a contribution. Here Now producer Lindsay Crudell drove around with the Cambridge, Massachusetts Department of Public Works Christmas tree removers, and she brought back this sound.
Hi, my name is Victor Camara.
Hi, my name is John Sullivan, and today I'm picking up trees for the city of Cambridge to have them recycled and mulched.
Do you ever look at those trees and imagine where they came from? That some kid probably opened up some presents underneath, and it, at one point was the center of the living room.
Yeah, sometimes we look at the size of these trees and they're enormous.
How many trees do you think you've picked up so far this week?
I've picked up more than 100 trees, I know that.
But it's not the end for the trees. Where do they go now?
They go into the chipper. We have other guys from the city chipping them up. A lot of people like to use the recycled mulch.
Over the course of collecting trees, have you guys become tree experts?
I said you can kind of tell which is the good ones, the heavy ones. You know, go to pick them up. Looks can be deceiving. You see the big stem on them, real thick and heavy.
Not as dry, too.
Not as dry. The drier ones tend to be a little cheaper tree. Gives you more of a better idea.
So which ones last longer?
You got the Douglas firs. Those are pretty much stay pretty green.
Do you ever see anything particularly strange on your tree pickup?
No, a lot of times people sometimes like to cut the branches off the trees. Just, instead of just dragging it out, they chop moss. You just see a big stem sometimes, and they leave the branches in a bag, you know.
There's one. How many trees do you think you have in the truck up there?
About 8 or 9. Maybe a few more. I've been stepping on to keep them down so I don't fall off, you know?
Do you ever ride up on top of that big mountain of trees in the back of the truck?
No, I don't think it's safe. They don't want us to do that.
So now we're going to go take the trees and put them in the chipper?
Yeah, we'll drop them down there. There's probably a lot of them already left out, but as they come, all different trucks, we'll throw them in the chipper. The tree crew will throw them in there.
It smells really nice.
Yeah, it does smell. I'll have it all on me now, my shirt, the needles and everything. I'll go home and smell this all day now, be like trees.
I'm watching you guys load the Christmas trees into the chipper, and in one end they're going in as whole Christmas trees, and on the other side there's just a blur of brown and green chips. So is this in your mind the official end of the holiday season?
Yeah, I think, yeah. You just kind of know. When you start picking these up, you know the holiday season's over.
What do you think when you look at that big pile of trees lying there?
Oh, it's got to be used for something else, so way to look at it. It ain't the end of them, I guess. It ain't the end of the story, the way to look at it.
Our trip with the tree removers was produced by Lindsay Crudell.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
1, 2, 3, 4.
A head-spinningly varied musical palette. That's how one writer described the music of the Holmes Brothers. And that seems about right if you listen to any random selection of cuts from their new CD, Simple Truths. The roots of the Holmes Brothers are in the Tidewater region of Virginia, where they grew up, amid rhythm and blues and gospel. But it seems those roots can blossom into just about anything musically. When Sherman and Wendell Holmes are doing the playing and the singing, and their longtime drummer Popsy Dixon's holding it all together. The Holmes Brothers and Popsy Dixon now join us from New York, and welcome to all of you.
Hey, Bill, how you doing, man?
Thank you for having us.
Doing great. Guys, before we get to what may kind of unify Holmes Brothers music, a common thread, if there is one, I thought we'd first give our listeners a taste of the diversity, the really amazing diversity on this new album, Simple Truths. Wendell, you're the lead guitarist on Run Myself Out of Town. Let's kick it right off with a little bit of that.
We'll be right back.
calling myself out of town by the Holmes brothers, Wendell Holmes on lead guitar. Wendell, that is a kind of a very blues-rooted song. That lead, did you make it up as you went along in the studio, or do you really plot something like that out?
You know, that's a great question, but actually, I did not plot it out. I wrote that song, incidentally,
yep.
And the guitar solo is just an improvised solo that just came to mind as I was doing it. I try to do it that way as much as I can without plotting things out.
You know, I thought what we'd do now is flip right over to a completely different song on this album, Simple Truths. A completely different song, a completely different feeling, a cover this time of Gillian Welch's Everything is Free. Let's take a listen.
Everything is free now. That's what they say. Everything I've ever done, gonna give it away. Someone hit the big store, they figured it out. We're gonna do it anyway.
What a contrast. Who's singing Gillian Welch's Everything is Free?
I am, Popsy.
Popsy's singing, the drummer.
Uh-huh.
Now, why is the album so extraordinarily diversified? You've got Townes Van Zandt songs, Bob Marley songs, Willie Nelson songs, Hank Williams songs. Is that something you consciously set out to do?
Well, actually, you know, we're not young men anymore, and we've been around a long time. And growing up in Virginia, we were exposed to so many different genres of music, from country to blues to gospel, and I always say that fortunately and unfortunately, many of the black stations, the wattage was not so much. We'd be listening to Jimmy Reed, and all of a sudden, bam, here's Hank Williams. So we got exposed to all different kinds, which was very good for us.
Your last album was Speaking in Tongues, was it not? Mm. Which was very much a kind of a contemporary gospel album, kind of spiritual soul music. Why'd you make the move to an album with such a diversified musical palette and in Simple Truth this time, instead of sticking with what worked so well last time? You're restless souls, are you?
I think we're restless souls, and we do try to experiment, and we're just looking for a key to keep us out of the old folks' home and try to get us heard more, you know?
There are very few musicians out there for the past 30, 40 years or so you guys haven't crossed paths with. You've backed up The Impressions, John Lee Hooker, Jerry Butler, a lot of other big names. What is the key to staying together for so many years?
I think it's love for one another and the brotherhood. And I tell people we've been together longer than most marriages. And we love each other. That's the main thing. We don't have to agree on everything, but we get along and we give each other space. That's the key.
Another really striking cut, striking that it would be on the album at all, to my way of thinking, is from a terrific band called Collective Soul, but they're a very intense rock band, which winds up on Simple Truth. Let's listen to a bit of Shine.
Give me a word, give me a sign, trouble and a look, and tell me what will I find? What will I find? Lord, teach me how to speak, teach me how to share, teach me where to go, and tell me will love me there.
Collective Soul's Shine, covered by the Holmes Brothers. What drew you to that song?
Well, you know, I believe that our manager, Brother Paul Kahn, brought that song to our attention, and we liked it. That's one of my favorites, actually. It's really a house rocker.
You know, when you listen to an album like Simple Truths, the title starts to make sense. You know, musical tastes change. There's something about the music on this album and the music that you guys make that does have something very consistent about it. My little daughter was sitting in the room while I was playing the album and just got right into it, and her musical tastes change about every 20 minutes.
I know.
What is that?
Well, I think that it stems from loving all kinds of music, and another part of it is being together for so many years that we feel what each other does, and it comes across that way, and we try to appeal to a wide range of audiences in age and cultures.
That's all true, of course, but there must be something coming out of the heart and the soul somehow. It doesn't have that plastic sheen on it, and even a little 10-year-old girl picks it up.
Well, I think one thing is we love to play.
Right.
You know, and I think that shows through a certain amount of honesty, maybe.
What keeps you going well beyond having to pay the rent?
I always say as long as you have the fire in your belly, you know, you're good to go, and we're still good to go. We all have that fire in our belly. As a matter of fact, we're getting ready to go on tour now, and we're always in the process of writing songs, trying to get ready for our next album because we don't want to be forgotten. We want your 10-year-old daughter to remember us as we fade on off the scene.
Let's hope she still listens when she's, you know, my age, which we want to go into. Thank you all so much for joining us on Here and Now.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you
again.
It's a pleasure.
Sherman Holmes, Wendell Holmes, and Popsy Dixon are the Holmes brothers. Their new album, Simple Truths, hits record stores today.
Is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Cradell, Emiko Tomagawa, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Matt One Thumb Odette and Boris Trapatsky. Our web producer is Zach Christo, and our intern is Ed Walters.
The senior producer of Here and Now, who has his whole hand, is Mark Navin.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Walking down the street with a whole black hair and hey, hey, baby, I want to know if you be my girl. And hey.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org. Or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Join us next time for the news and these stories, Here and Now.
President Bush wants to send an American to Mars. We'll talk to a journalist who does the math and says the numbers don't even come close to adding up.
And a look at the downside of the facelift.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.